Hi everybody, today is Friday, July 11th, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
And Nima's back. Oh, he's got the shirt on, got the haircut. Oh man, all cleaned up, looking really professional.
Larry, I want to start with your latest piece on your website. And here is what you wrote. And let me just bring it on. Yeah.
Ukraine is burning.
Ukraine is burning and Russia advances.
Yeah.
What's going on vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine?
We've seen a significant uptick in Russia's airstrikes with drones, missiles. I mean, extraordinary numbers, upwards of 700, 500, you know, and it's not just one time, it's night after night. And what it highlights is Ukraine's diminished air defense capability. And Russia now really, I think that this is a response to Operation Spiderweb, you know, the attack that took place on June 1st. Russia has really ramped up that. Okay, they're gonna finish this militarily. There's no intent to negotiate. Negotiating an end to this is just it's a Western fantasy. And I think the Russian leadership recognizes they have no alternative but to crush Ukraine militarily on the battlefield, and by extension crushing the West. The absurdity of Donald Trump said, oh yeah, he's going to send 10 missiles, 10 Patriot missiles to Ukraine. So I show a video in there of within less than a minute, you get four Iskander strikes in Kiev. And I mean, they go boom, boom, boom. Okay. If they had a functioning Patriot missile battery, to try to shoot that down. And apparently they did, so you could see some air defense shots went up in the air, you know, completely ineffective. But if they tried to shoot that down, they'd shoot two Patriot missiles for each one of those Iskanders. Okay, let's do the math. 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2, four times. That's 8. So right there in 1 minute, 8 of the 10 missiles that Donald Trump's going to send would have been gone. And they did nothing. So it's a reminder that the Russians have a decided advantage with respect to drones and missiles. And then on the ground, down in Zaporizhia in particular, in the south, and the Russians are advancing rapidly. They're taking two or three towns a day. The same in Donetsk. They're forming a big cauldron or pocket around Pokrovsk, and Pokrovsk, once they take that, that is going to basically be like unlocking a door, and it's going to open the way for more rapid advance to finish the conquest of Donetsk and the expulsion of all Ukrainians. And then up north in Sumy and Kharkiv, the Russians continue to advance and push out, trying to create a buffer zone. Ukraine's in trouble. That's the simplest way to put it. And yet, despite the situation on the ground militarily, you've got, you know, Europe still beating its chest, trying to say, "Oh yeah, we're gonna line up and support Ukraine." If I read the article right today, Ukraine just signed an agreement with, maybe it was the UK or France. They're going to produce 300 air defense missiles. Ooh, you know, that'll last, you know, a couple of minutes. And so Europe seems to be coming, the longer this war goes on, Europe appears to become more bellicose and more threatening of Russia. And yet Europe is completely incapable of standing toe-to-toe with Russia militarily, completely incapable. So this thing is moving towards an end game, and very well this, you know, this if Putin's right, this could be the last year of the war, because he talked about they're going to reduce defense spending next year. I don't think you reduce defense spending if you're planning planning to still go on and wage an extended war.
Was Europe successful in the way that they were trying to manipulate the administration in Washington, the Trump administration? Here is, Larry, before going to that, here is what Merz said.
Yeah.
I have two messages. The one goes to Moscow and to President Putin. The message is quite simple. We will not give up. And dear friends, my second message goes to Washington, D.C. and to President Donald Trump. Stay with us and stay with the Europeans. We are on the same page and we are looking for a stable political order in this world. We are both, the Americans and the Europeans are part of with us. Stay with us on this side and on this page of our common history.
The problem is that I don't see any of these two leaders, any of these two presidents, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, caring about what Merz is talking about.
Well, have you ever watched any of those World War II documentaries where Adolf Hitler's addressing the Reichstag and all the Nazis are out there doing this? That's what that reminds me of. You know, Merz is... You know, it never ceases to amaze me that a guy with that kind of experience, that kind of education, can be so damn stupid and just out of touch with reality. You can't even sit down and accurately calculate what's taking place. Germany has no means and or ability to, you know. They got their ass kicked in World War II by the Soviets, principally. What, they want to go back for seconds? And, you know, Russia, from a historical standpoint, the Germans killed 27 million Russians. Russia doesn't have a warm spot in its heart for them. So, you know, what Merz is doing is just, he's out of touch with reality. I don't have words for it.
Do you feel that Donald Trump is in charge, Larry, in Washington, in what's going on, in whatever whatever decision that they're trying to make, whatever policy, and it seems that Donald Trump somehow, I don't know if he's receiving the intelligence from what's going on really on the battlefield in Ukraine, because somehow it says that I've sent them ammunition. I don't know who's going to send them, who's signing the letters.
Yeah.
Who's in charge in Washington? Let me, before going to that, here is what he said, Larry.
Hey, you said that you were not sure who ordered the munitions halted to Ukraine. Have you since been able to figure that out?
Well, I haven't thought about it because we're looking at Ukraine right now and munitions, but I have not gone into it.
What does it say that such a big decision could be made inside your government without you knowing?
I would know. If a decision was made, I will know. I'll be the first to know. In fact, most likely I'd give the order, but I haven't done that yet.
So who ordered the pause last week?
I don't know. What did you tell me?
I think that's a question.
Yeah, no, I mean, Trump's losing it. I mean, he's got some mental issues. I think we're witnessing a different type of senility than what we saw with Joe Biden, but it's the same thing. I've spoken to someone who has had several meetings with Trump over the last 18 months. And he said that based on the recent meetings, he said there's a noticeable deterioration in Trump's mental faculties. Let's put it that way. And it's dangerous. You know what that he had no idea, and you know, this is the guy claims he knows everything. And you know, it's not just here. There are, you know, he is, you know, reverses himself on sending weapons, and then he's talking about sending more weapons to Ukraine. So it's just, and then the whole Jeffrey Epstein issue. That's good Lord. You know, where he's created a real firestorm on that. It really done damage to himself politically, because there are a lot of so-called MAGA supporters who are just disgusted by this. And then, you know, just simple example of when he's meeting with those African leaders the other day, and, you know, here's the president of Liberia. And for people that don't know, Liberia was set up by a bunch of slaves from America, black Africans who went back to Liberia. They spoke English. And Trump goes, "Oh, your English is beautiful. Where'd you learn to speak English? You should have said in Alabama." You know, God damn. It's and then just go back and look at that. Play that, you know, the first part of that tape. Look at his eyes. Look at his face. You know, something's not right. So, you know, we could see actually Trump being the first president removed from office through the 25th Amendment. Joe Biden should have been. But I think we're likely to see that from Trump, because he is erratic beyond imagination on everything. So this is, you know, to believe that Pete Hegseth alone, without consulting with the White House, without at least running it by Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, say, "Hey, we're gonna put a halt to these weapons that are supposed to go forward to Ukraine," to pretend that the White House didn't know about that? Please.
With the case of Epstein, Larry, what is, in your opinion, what's your speculation? Many people are speculating, by the way, on what's going on with Donald Trump and his administration. Elon Musk said that he's in the files, he's in the list, that's why he's hesitant to publish them. But on the other hand, we have people who see the behavior of Donald Trump as a leverage on the people, on the opposite parties, and on the Democratic Party. He can use it against them to just silence them, something like that. What is in this documents that he tries not to publish them?
Well, first of all, I don't think he's on the list at all. If he had been, do you think that the Biden administration and Biden's cronies would have kept that silent? Are you kidding me? They were throwing everything they possibly could at Trump. So, you know, yes, and Trump was friends with the Epstein for, you know, around 10 years, you know, back when. But for, you know, maybe to Trump's credit, he didn't succumb to the blackmail activities that Epstein was promoting. That said, I think there are two principal reasons why I'm going to pretend that there is no Epstein client list. There is a client list. I published it on my site, sonar21.com, the other day, but it was put together by Ryan Dawson. Ryan didn't just make this list up. He went through the court documents, the testimony of the victims of Epstein, who identified specific people. And when you go through that list, there are a number of prominent people, some who are supportive of or close to Trump, like Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan Chase. So you can make the case that maybe Trump wants the list to go away to protect some of, friends, people that are supporters of his. That's one possibility. But I think a more likely possibility, and the former prosecutor Acosta, who was Secretary of Labor, had said that when he was bringing charges, the first time he brought charges against Epstein, he was approached and said, hey, basically, he's an intelligence asset. You got to leave him alone. I think Epstein, and when you go back and trace his career, I think he became an asset of both Mossad, and I think the CIA had some hooks into him. So proceeding with, in the past when Trump said, we're going to release the Epstein file, he wasn't briefed on it. He never looked at it. I don't think he really understood, because if he had understood then about the intel side of it, he probably wouldn't have said a thing and made it an issue. Now he's created a real problem for himself. So, let's not forget, Epstein was killed while Donald Trump was president. Now there's some interesting photos out there. I don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole on this, but there was a photograph taken of Epstein on the gurney at the prison when his body was being taken out. It's a side profile. And someone has compared that with another picture of Epstein where you can see the nose and the ear. They're different. So you got to look at the possibility, was Epstein's death faked, staged, in order to get him out of the country? And, he's not going to surface publicly, but, as an intelligence asset, that's a possibility too. But, Trump's created a real problem for himself among his base, that there are many people that voted for him that will no longer support him based on this.
Larry, getting back to the conflict in Ukraine, Donald Trump, he said that every time he talks with Vladimir Putin, it's so nice and he's trying to be so much coordinating and somehow helping him to understand the situation, but nothing else coming out of these talks. And he's so nice, but no outcome for what Donald Trump wants to achieve. And what is the main goal of Donald Trump? Because we know that Marco Rubio has met with Lavrov in Kuala Lumpur, and they were talking about the conflict in Ukraine. No Witkoff. Steve Witkoff is not in the scene.
Right. Right.
Marco Rubio coming forward. What's going on?
Well, Donald Trump wants a Nobel Peace Prize. And so he wants everybody to do what he wants. He's not listening to Russia. We're now more than a year ago, June 14th, 2024, Vladimir Putin spoke to the foreign ministry in Russia, laid out very clearly what the demands of Russia are. Now, those demands actually are getting a little tougher now. There was a point, we go back 3 years ago, Russia was willing to cut a deal with Ukraine that would have allowed Donetsk and Luhansk to remain as part of Ukraine. They would have had a special protection. But now, no. Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, Kherson, those are permanently part of Russia. That's not going back. And Russia is, every place where Russian boots are on the ground, they're going to keep that territory too, which means Dnipropetrovsk, Sumy, for starters. So Trump's just not listening. Putin said it, Lavrov said it, Rybkov said it, Peskov said it, Maria Zakharova said it. You know, it's been repeated over and over and over and over. And Trump's just refusing to listen. You know, they think somehow they can persuade Russia to give up territory or to retreat. This is very, very simple. Russia wants an end to NATO on its borders, and Ukraine is going to have no part of that, and Ukraine's not going to be part of the EU. And, you know, if the West is willing to make that kind of agreement now, fine, Russia will take it. If not, Russia's going to make it happen on the battlefield. And there's not a damn thing the United States and the Europeans can do about it. They can whine, they can cry, but Russia's going to roll on.
Is Donald Trump going to put new sanctions on Russia, much more as it was, as it came in the bill prepared by Lindsey Graham? Because recently he said that he's considering what Lindsey Graham has prepared to put sanctions on Russia.
Well, the sanctions, what Lindsey Graham's talking about is actually sanctioning India and China, not Russia, trying to hurt Russia indirectly. So all Trump is doing, if he goes along with that, is making the case for BRICS. The BRICS, the rest of the world is saying, hey, we've got to get out from under the U.S. thumb. Notice that already, you know, we go back 4 or 5 years ago, China was buying the bulk of its soybeans and corn. They're buying that from the United States. Corn, wheat. Not now. They're now buying primarily from Brazil, Russia, and Argentina to a lesser extent. Well, and so they don't have to worry about dollars either. So what Trump and his belligerence and antagonism is producing is driving other countries to distance themselves from the United States. They don't want to have any part of them.
We have the BRICS summit in Brazil. They condemn the attacks. But when you look at the BRICS and the way that they were trying to somehow dealing with the financial issues, the issues that they have in terms of their economy, dealing with the United States and geopolitical issues, do you consider it as a success, as somehow a step forward, or you see the BRICS have the internal differences among the BRICS countries is just somehow it's getting more bold?
Well, no, actually, I thought the summit came out far better than I expected. You know, I candidly thought Brazil was going to drop the ball and that Brazil was going to be so susceptible to pressure from the United States that it would actually sabotage it. Instead, they were able to, you know, come out with, you know, very lengthy statement, you know, agreement. And, you know, it's just the mere act of coming together, interacting and talking with one another against the backdrop of Trump making threats. And I'm going to sanction you. You know, it just makes him realize, hey, you know, we got to work together. We cannot be under the threat of the United States. You know, they don't want to live under the constant threat that the United States is going to try to bankrupt them. So, you know, I think it actually came off pretty good. I was surprised. Because up to that point, you know, and Pepe has talked about it before, they didn't see the kind of preparations going on that Russia did when they had Kazan, you know, the summit at Kazan a year ago. So this is, you know, this means it's progressing. We're witnessing the birth of a new economic system, and it's not going to arrive on just one day. It's like an elephant being born, you know, it takes a while. So this is, if anything, Trump's threats and actions are spurring them forward to develop BRICS, because already, you know, you've got the 21 BRICS countries combined account for about almost 50% of the world's economic activity, as measured by purchasing power parity. They represent over 55% of the world's population, just those 21 countries. And so as this, I think it's going to continue to expand. A number of countries in Africa have, you know, once they join, in particular the countries from the Sahel, I would anticipate at some point they will definitely seek to become part of BRICS. So it's really going to become, if you will, I think it's headed towards be an alternative to the United Nations, because in light of the U.S., you know, action against Francesca Albanese this week, to sanction her for doing her job and for calling out Israel for its murderous genocidal behavior. You know, when the United States wants to put her in jail, you know, prevent her from, you know, who knows, they're going to seize her bank account. You know, it's outrageous. The United States is just, you know, it's crossing a line. And so, whenever you have to start ruling by fear, you've lost. And that's where the United States is. Nobody wants to follow our example. No one now wants to be like us, just the opposite. Don't be like the United States. It is vindictive. It's a bully, is how it's coming across. I think that's how it's being perceived.
I don't know who's advising Donald Trump on the case of Brazil, that he tries to put 50%.
Wait, stop. Advising Donald, you think Donald Trump will listen to advice? What's wrong with you?
Because he wants to interfere in what's going on here in Brazil, domestic policy, and putting sanction on Brazilian in order to achieve something with the internal policy of Brazil. It's so strange. It's unbelievable.
When you're the smartest guy in the world, where you're the best, the most brilliant, why not? I mean, that's how, you know, Trump, I don't know if you've read Andrei Martyanov's blog the other day, where he did a three-paragraph quotation from this one psychiatrist about narcissistic personalities. And, you know, if anybody hasn't read it, they should go read it. It describes Donald Trump to a T. And as he gets older, you know, because the man's approaching, you know, 80, and there is a tendency to, you know, I saw it with my mother when she, you know, before she passed. If you get older, you become more uninhibited. You are less careful about what you say and how you say things, or you tend to become more of what you may really be. Trump's a bully. And, you know, you're seeing it with his outbursts of, you know, when he said, they don't know what the fuck they're doing, or but it's bullshit, putting his bullshit, you know. You didn't hear that from Trump for, you know, 8 years ago, yeah, or, you know, 6 years ago when he was president. So, as I said, there's something wrong with him now. And because he has such a narcissistic edge, you can't, you can't tell him. He won't listen. I go back to my earlier prediction. I really think that Trump will be removed from office before his term is up.
Larry, Netanyahu's visit to the United States, he went to the Pentagon visiting Pete Hegseth, and Pete Hegseth was somehow admiring the way that they have collaborated during the attack on Iran. And What does Netanyahu want from the United States? What is the main goal of this visit? Is a new attack on Iran? Is it a somehow buying new air defense systems or trying to convince Donald Trump to send more weapons to Israel? We know that Pentagon has announced that they have signed a new contract, a new, I don't know, agreement between the government and the arm production to produce more drones, and it seems that they're hugely investing for the case of drones. But how is that? I don't see how the United States would use these drones unless they're going to give it to Israel. They're going to give it to Ukraine. They're going to use it. Well, the United States doesn't need drones to. They're not fighting anybody.
Well, actually, you know, up to this point, the United States has been, you know, heavily invested in the big drones, like the MQ-9 Reaper. So they're, where they cost $30, $35 million a piece. I mean, very expensive. It's like buying a combat jet. So the United States is not a leader in building the kinds of smaller drones that are used so extensively on the battlefields in Ukraine. So I can't see Israel coming to us for that because we don't have it. Mm-hmm. If Israel wants to replenish its air defense system, good luck with that. Ours doesn't work. The Patriot and the THAAD systems proved to be ineffectual in Israel in the face of Iranian ballistic missiles. Plus, you know, Iran's got three variations of hypersonic missiles. And they didn't really, I think they only used the Fatah in a couple of the attacks. So they held back their most advanced missiles during this 12-day war. They didn't go full out. I think Netanyahu's primary purpose is to come in and figure out what next. Now, you got to step back and say, okay, is Trump trying to negotiate a ceasefire? So he would like to get that, you know, get the Nobel Peace Prize. He keeps talking about that. He's come out and been very strong in defending Netanyahu against the corruption charges and calling for them to be dismissed. So, you know, on the one hand, I could see him saying to Netanyahu, okay, look, I've got these charges dismissed. I've got a postponement in the court case for you. Now I need you to do something for me. You need to back off and accept the ceasefire proposal. So I could see some negotiation like that taking place. I don't see Israel lining up, you know, Netanyahu would need to come say, oh, I need more aid. Well, he's already getting it. The United States wasn't withholding anything. You could almost make the case that they were running out of items, they had saturated themselves. They didn't need any more, but they're getting conventional bombs. And I also think one of the issues was figure, okay, what do we do with Iran? What next? Because the operation that was launched on June 13th, that exposed a significant Israeli intelligence network in Iran. And there have been some other reports that a very senior Mossad official was captured by Iran and executed. The hopes of a regime change are, I think, dissipated. And Iran is, I think that attack sort of, it awakened, as you've pointed out, it awakened national pride in Iran, brought about a unity that hadn't been there before. And maybe Netanyahu realizes that now, and they're trying to figure out, okay, now what do we do? We've created a problem for ourselves.
I think they were somehow investing too much on the position of Iranian government outside of Iran. They thought that they can gain something for them to replace the government in Iran with these oppositions, but the things didn't happen the way that they were expecting to happen.
Yeah.
And here is, Larry, what the Iranian parliament speaker, Ghalibaf, his name is Mohammad Ghalibaf, and he said that in the final stages of the conflict between Iran and Israel, more than 90% of missiles hit the Israeli target.
Mm-hmm.
It seems, you remember when during the last days of the conflict, the war, the number of missiles have been reduced drastically. And we were talking about why they're reducing the number of missiles.
Well, I'm not sure that's what the Israeli propagandists were putting out. I don't recall Iran saying, "Hey, we launched X number of missiles today."
They didn't mention that. No.
They would simply say, "Yeah, it's
new wave of missiles are coming in."
It was like number 21,
yeah,
number 22. They did 22 iterations, I think, over the course of 12 days. So. It's clear that Iran, I do know that Israeli intelligence and many in the U.S. government believe that Iran only had like 300 missiles. they're going to run out. They're going to run out any day.
Wow.
I know that General Mike Flynn, retired. That was the line he was pushing. Then I was like, are you kidding? the only way the United States
would, even Houthis,
you said Iran's got less missiles than the Houthis, really? Of course, remember those Houthis, they capitulated, right? They gave up. Oh, we give up. The fact that with Israel, with Iran constructing the missiles underground and then storing them underground, unless the United States or some other intelligence organization has successfully recruited somebody who has access to the production facility and or the storage facility, no way we're going to have any clue, because you can't see through the ground. So, my guess is that Iran is certainly well around in excess of 10,000 missiles. Now, what kind in each category, that I don't know. But I suspect since the attacks on the last attack on June 24 by the United States, that Iran is busy underground building more missiles. They're restocking them, resupplying themselves. So it is, Israel and the United States created a problem for themselves, because Iran's not going away. Regime change ain't happening. Iran's growing closer militarily with Russia and China. They've got a more unified population.
With no limits that they were somehow trying to do before.
Yeah. So this is, meanwhile, in Israel, the Samsonite option is underway. The Samsonite option is where the Israelis pack their bags, their Samsonite suitcases, and get the hell out of the country. You've got a significant number. There's some interesting, I've been told, I haven't seen the surveys myself, and I don't know if it's actually true, but reportedly, upwards of 70% of the Israelis are considering, now we got to go find work elsewhere. We got to get out of the country. So, if they get that kind of exodus out, then they really are in trouble.
Larry, what is Yemen trying to do? Yemen has seen two ships that they were going to Israel. And it's when it comes to this sort of attack on the part of Yemenis, we have to understand what's going on in Gaza, mm-hmm. in my opinion. in Gaza, they're trying to send people to some sort of prison in the southern part, in Rafah, in southern part of Gaza, and just gathering these people and maybe then deporting and sending them to other countries. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, it's crazier than that. The Trump administration reportedly is trying to persuade several of the West African countries like Liberia and such, hey, we take these Palestinians? What? I mean, it's just, you're going to go and forcibly load them up in cattle cars like the Nazis did to Jews in Eastern Europe? It's outrageous. So the Houthis, to their credit, they mean what they said. Hey, we're going to fight on behalf of the Palestinian people and make sure that there's no ships that they're going to come through the Red Sea. They get to go to Israel. We'll destroy them. And they're doing it. And, you know, despite getting bombed by Israel, they continue to launch missiles, you know, ballistic missiles into Ben Gurion Airport, trying to, you know, shut it down. So I'm sure that was one issue on the agenda between Netanyahu and Trump. You know, maybe Netanyahu trying to beg Trump, oh, send your aircraft carrier back to the Red Sea so the Houthis can sink it. Yeah. Another, you know, yeah, come back for 7 weeks of spending $2 or $3 billion you don't have. So the Houthis have proven, they have exposed the myth of Israeli and U.S. military invincibility. Because now all of a sudden you sit there and say, look at what those Houthis forced the United States out of the Persian Gulf. I mean, out of the Red Sea. Forced them out. And despite repeated attacks by Israel, Houthis are still able, Yemen is still able to launch attacks on Israel. So, like I said, it sends a message. And then top that off with what Iran inflicted the most damage on Israel that any country has ever done in its 78-year history. So I think that's significant from that standpoint. So Israel, I don't think Israel is going to be successful in fully executing its genocidal policy. I think they're going to be, you know, Trump wants this Abraham Accord. And he keeps saying, oh, yeah, I've got all these countries that are ready to sign up. Well, not really. You know, Saudi Arabia saying, yeah, we'll sign up. Palestinians have to have a state. Give them a state or we'll sign the agreement. No state, no agreement. So, and I think, you know, frankly, Trump, with his, you know, blind support of Israel and the actions he took against Iran during the 12-day war have caused further distrust among the Gulf Arabs about the United States, man. Can't trust them.
What has happened, Larry, for the case of two-state solution? He was asked, Donald Trump was asked during the meeting with Netanyahu, he was asked about the two-state solution. He didn't answer it. He just asked Netanyahu to respond. He said the best person to answer this question would be Netanyahu. And Netanyahu also didn't answer it. He said something else and then talk about Abraham Accord. It seems that the two-state solution, even in the mind of the Trump administration, is not there anymore. Yeah, as the Biden administration was trying so hard to talk and at least talk about it.
It's Israel's only potential salvation if Israel wants to continue to exist as a country. I think the way the dynamics are moving is that Israel's very existence can be called into question. You know, they are they don't have the military force. I mean, they haven't defeated Hamas, and Hamas keeps running. So they've conducted 2 or 3 major ambushes in the last 2 weeks. that have killed probably over 20 Israeli soldiers and wounded, you know, when you take them all combined, you know, they've killed five here, eight there. So, you know, the numbers add up, and then the number of wounded. Israel can't sustain those kinds of losses. And yet, here they are, the most, allegedly the most powerful military in the Middle East, and they can't defeat Hamas. They've been unable to. You know, we're people want to, you know, criticize Russia for its slow pace of advance in Ukraine, but there, Russia's up against a peer army, an army that's equipped and trained by NATO. It's you know, they've got NATO intelligence. They've got, you know, they've got tanks. They've got anti-tank weapons. They've got mortars. They've got artillery. They've got missiles. And so Russia's up against, you know, a real threat. What's Israel up against? A bunch of guys with rifles and pistols. That's it. Some mortars, some RPGs. They don't have artillery. They don't have advanced intelligence collection systems providing them information. You know, the tanks, the armored personnel carriers, the artillery, then the combat aircraft that come over and drop bombs, you know. And there's Hamas up against that. It's a miracle that they're still standing. I mean, it is. It's remarkable. This is, you know, there was a lot of mythology built up around the Jewish uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto during World War II. Leon Uris wrote a book called Mila 18. And, you know, they lasted a month. They lasted 4 weeks against the Nazis. Well, here is Israel applying Nazi tactics against the Palestinians, and Hamas is still standing, you know, for, you know, we're coming close to the 2-year mark in October. So, you know, August, September. So we're 3 months, over 21 months, over 20 months into this war. Israel can't beat Hamas. So what's the solution? You know, Israel's going to have to actually negotiate. And if enough of the other, you know, if the Arab countries come together to really say, okay, we're going to tell the United States, you're getting no more cooperation from us until the rights of the Palestinians are respected. But that would also incumbent upon countries like Egypt to intervene. There's no hope that Erdogan and Turkey would do the right thing. You know, he's worse than a poisonous snake. But, you know, this I retain some level of hope anyway that you know, Hamas will ultimately, and the Palestinians will ultimately prevail over over these genocidal maniacs.
Those people who are arguing that Israel is winning has won so far, Larry, when we compare Israel today from what compared to what it was before October 7th, look at Israel today.
Yeah.
In terms of their economy, in terms of the situation in Israel, and the army of Israel, they were everybody was talking about Israel before October 7th, that they're the best army in the Middle East, the most advanced army in the Middle East. It's
right.
All breaking down. It's all. How about the political view on Israel? How about the way that the countries are seeing Israel, right?
Well, yeah, their international reputation is completely trashed. You know, for prior to this, Israel actually had cultivated a pretty good image overseas among several countries, and that when there'd be a disaster, like in Turkey, they'd send in a rescue team, you know, dog and rescue workers, and they would provide aid in the aftermath of some sort of natural disaster. But not now. The images of the genocide are too prevalent. They can't control that. And it's on all the media. And it's just, they're sickening what people are seeing. And these emaciated bodies that look like, you know, we saw these horrific images out of World War II when the various concentration camps were liberated in Germany. Didn't have any really good footage out of the death camps that were in Poland, but you know, you did get the photos out of Bergen-Belsen, Dachau, Sachsenhausen. You're seeing that now in Palestine, in Gaza. I mean, they're just skin and bones. It's like a skeleton with skin draped over it. Israel's doing that to human beings. And, you know, the world's taking notice. And God bless Francesca Albanese for her courage in speaking out against this. And, you know, it's a shameful indictment, not only of Israel, but of the United States, that the U.S. would dare to try to punish her and sanction her for trying to be a voice of humanity.
You mentioned how Israel destroyed its image, but they're destroying the U.S. image as well, Larry. It's not just about, because somehow we talk about the people, the public opinion, but people are seeing the way that the United States is supporting during the Biden administration, right now the Trump administration. They're supporting whatever Netanyahu wants to do with Gazans, with the Palestinians. This is hugely influential, in my opinion, to the picture of the United States and the future and the way that they want to be recognized in history in the future and the way that other countries would deal with the United States. Because as time goes by with the BRICS, with all these changes that are happening, the United States, no one would imagine that the United States would prevail. They are, United States, in my opinion, would be a great country, but after all, it doesn't seem that this support for Israel, the way that they're supporting it, would help the United States.
Well, it's not. We need to separate out two things. So, from the standpoint of Israel and its control over the U.S. political system, that Republican, Democrat alike are completely compromised by the money that has been provided through AIPAC and other prominent, wealthy Jewish donors. And it's a sad statement that U.S. policy is seemingly held hostage to Israeli interests, the Zionist interests. But you're beginning to see a movement away from that, because of the crowd that's basically under the age of 40, they ain't buying it. Not a lot of them are saying, "Oh yeah, Israel, right or wrong, you know, we'll die for Israel." That's starting to go away. And you know, I think Israel is going to have a real public relations problem in the United States going forward. So, as far as U.S. reputation goes, yeah, it's a blind support for all things that Israel does and protecting Israel. It's only part of the damage that's being done, because it's U.S. foreign policy across the board. Now, particularly under Donald Trump, Trump is making it worse. You know, he keeps saying, "Oh, yeah, well, America's back. We're the strongest. We're the greatest. We're the best." And other countries are going, "Hey, man, you're just a damn bully. You know, all you do is threaten us." And, you know, and here's Trump sending out these stupid tariff letters to countries. It's just a form letter. And no attempt to actually engage the leaders of those countries. And so, you know, they're trying to keep the United States at arm's length the best they can. And if they're around Trump, oh, man, they'll pour butter on his ass. "Oh, Mr. President, you're so great. You're so smart. You're so wonderful." And Trump said, "Yeah, I know. Yeah, man. Yeah, I am. I am so good." I mean, it's so twisted. I mean, you'd think, you know, the world, some of the world leaders need to stand up and say, hey, dude, you know, you're delusional, you're narcissistic, and you're out of touch with reality. And no, you're not going to tell us what to do. And so that's where, you know, that's where Brooks is starting to come from. But even, you know, you've yet to see Xi of China or Putin of Russia come out and just, you know, finally call Donald Trump out for the crazy nut that he is. And it's unfortunate. I was hopeful when Trump was elected and inaugurated that we were going to see that he would have been humbled, if you will, by the, you know, the attempts on his life, and that the unfair, legitimately unfair prosecutions of him in an attempt to destroy him, that he would have come out of that with a more, if you will, charitable outlook. Phew. So much for that, man. That's not happening. He's out of control. And they are deliberately embracing delusions. So it puts the world in a more dangerous position, unfortunately.
Larry, have you heard that voice file of Donald Trump in 2024 talking about the way that he was dealing? Let me play it for you.
Yeah.
And because it's good to have the bigger picture of what's going on in the mind of Donald Trump.
And Putin has said, if you go in to Ukraine, we're going to bomb the shit out of Moscow. I'm telling you, I have no choice. The public. So he goes like, I don't believe you. He said, no way. And I said, way. And then he goes like, I don't believe you. But the truth is, he believed me 10%. And I told you this, he believed me 10%. Then I'm with President Xi of China, but I said the same thing to them. I said, you know, if you go into Taiwan, I'm going to bomb the shit out of Beijing. He thought I was crazy. He said, Beijing, you're going to bomb me? I said, I have no choice. I got to bomb them. We're going to bomb Beijing. And he didn't believe me either, except 10%. And 10% is all you need. In fact, 5% would have been okay too. And we never had a problem. We would have never had a problem.
Yeah, he's delusional. I mean, this is classic narcissistic behavior, and it's when in its most extreme form, to say things that are not even grounded in reality. But Putin, when Trump left office on January 20th of 2021. Putin wasn't talking about invading Ukraine then. Putin wasn't lining up soldiers and deploying forces to the borders. What's Trump talking about? And, you know, he doesn't even, yeah, well, I told Putin. He wasn't in conversation with Putin. Man, he's talking to imaginary people. It's disturbing. I regret to say I voted for him, and I'll be the first to say he ought to be impeached and removed from office. Now, he's dangerous. What he's doing is dangerous.
Larry, do you feel that something big going to come up with the case of China? Because there's some rumors that the situation between the United States and China is getting to the next step, getting to the next level. How is that going to, in your opinion, with the case of tariff, we saw what has happened, but are we going to see something more than that? Something, a movement of weapons, something like that, that would bring some sort of tensions, substantial, I would say some important tensions between the two.
Well, I don't think the Chinese are stupid, and all they have to do is listen and pay attention to what to what's being said in the United States about China. China is an enemy. China, we're going to go to war with China. I mean, we've got U.S. military officials out in Indo-PACOM that have openly said that, that they expect to be at war with China next year. So, you know, if you're the Chinese and you're hearing that, what do? You start taking steps to defend yourself and make sure that the United States understands that you're going to fiercely protect your territory. And, you know, if I'm the Chinese, I'm also sitting there watching, hey, the United States talks tough, but they can't produce, they don't have the ships that we do. They can't sustain artillery production, artillery shells. Their air defense sucks. They don't have hypersonic missiles. We do. China has, and it probably is the leader with the hypersonic missile technology. United States can't even produce one. So, you know, I think they recognize that the United States is potentially dangerous in that regard, but they're going to they will confront us. Now, the United States is, we're making a big deal about, oh, the Chinese are buying up land, farmland near our military bases. You know, do you think for a minute the United States would be trying to buy up farmland in China? You know, it's just, we like to do to others what we don't want them doing to us. You know, it's the reverse of the golden rule. But, you know, the China, well, it was at the foreign minister the other day. He made it very clear that, hey, we can't afford to see Russia lose to Ukraine, because if they do, we know that we're next on the chopping block. You know, so credit, kudos to him. He understands. And I think the Chinese leadership understand the United States is a threat. We're not a friendly, benign country. We're the only country in the world that has carried out the invasions of five invasions of other countries over the last 60 years. Only one. I mean, you know, if you're going to judge that, who's spending the most money funding terrorists? We are. The United States is, not Iran, not China, not Russia. We are. And, you know, other countries, we can't. In America, we are in denial about a lot of this, but the other countries understand it and recognize it. We're the threat. We like to think that we're the innocent here, that, oh, we're just minding our own business, all these people picking on us, but it's not the case. We're a threat, and these countries have to be prepared to deal with us. You know, I hope the United States survives, candidly, because I think we're on a path to destroy ourselves with this kind of reckless, erratic behavior that's exemplified by Donald Trump. But he's not the only one. Look at all the bobbleheads around him going, yeah, Mr. President, yeah, you're the greatest, you're the best, oh, for Christ's sake.
Somehow they're so hawkish. They're so much, I would say, even more than the way that they're toward Russia. They see China as the ultimate goal, as the ultimate target.
Yeah. And China still got a lot of cards to play, particularly with its control of rare earth minerals, minerals that we absolutely have to have. And without it, our war machine breaks down. If I was the Chinese, I'd say we're not sending another bit of rare earth mineral to the United States. Let them collapse.
Can we say, Larry, that the risk of having a nuclear war between in the Middle East and in Ukraine has diminished since Donald Trump took office in Washington?
No. Just the opposite. It's grown. The threat is greater. And, the potential for war breaking out in particular between Russia and NATO, is high. Up in the Baltic, these different European poodles are trying to interfere with Russia's ships. There's tankers coming out. So Russia's now accompanied, having them escorted by military vessels. The chances of a confrontation, an accident taking place, and then where a hot shooting war starts, I think it's significant. It's high. You can't always count on people doing the right thing, the smart thing. But if the West dares to get into that kind of shooting war with Russia, they're going to, you know, I don't know if they'll live to regret it. They will end up regretting it. And the same thing with the efforts to sow subversion and to use Azerbaijan and Turkey to further inflame the area, the destruction of Iran is still high on the agenda, both of Israel and the United States. So yeah, we're in a much more dangerous time now.
It seems that if they decide to play with the Azerbaijani card and the way that they have somehow manipulating the situation against Iran and Russia, they can choose another route of getting from this corridor that comes north-south corridor between Iran and Russia and goes down. It seems that they can ignore Azerbaijan. They can go through other countries or in the sea. They can use the sea to access Iranian ports. And I don't know if Azerbaijan is interested in that happening to them. They want, in my opinion, they want to be part of this project. But how it comes to how influential is Turkey together with the United States on the policies in Azerbaijan and the way that they would behave?
Well, no, I think Turkey is enormously influential in this, and that is collaborating. I mean, this, you know, Erdogan wants to be the man. He wants to be, you know, the new sultan, if you will, of the whole area. And to that end, Azerbaijan's been playing along. But Russia still has some resources and ability to exercise some influence in there. Aliyev is playing a very dangerous game. And, you know, if Russia's not going to permit Aliyev to create a real threat to Russia, they'll take him out before that. In the same way that the United States wouldn't allow that to go on in Canada or Mexico, just from, you know, self-interest, self-protection, self-defense. But clearly, they're talking about this an east-west economic road. I forget the particular name of it, that will flow through Azerbaijan, wind up in Turkey, go through Armenia, and Armenia is being left out. I mean, Armenia is basically being told to sit down, shut up, and take what we give you. So there's still potential for a lot of further conflict, and then on top of it, what Azerbaijan did in facilitating Israel's attack on Iran. There's no doubt about that. So we'll have to wait and see what, it's one more thing on Russia's plate that has to worry about.
I think Russia needs to rethink of what's going on with the project in terms of the participation of Azerbaijan. It seems to me that Azerbaijan has the capabilities to turn in a new Germany for Russia, investing.
I don't disagree with you on that. But it's, I said, Russia right now is preoccupied with settling, getting the Ukraine situation settled. I think, you know, I think what we're seeing is a significant acceleration in the Russian operations. That's how we started this conversation, that Russia's going for a military defeat. I think they recognize that's the only way they're going to bring this to an end. I disagree with some like Professor John Mearsheimer, who talks about it being a frozen conflict. You know, that we had people, remember, you know, a year ago, there were people talking about, oh, this war is a stalemate. It wasn't a stalemate. You know, it is. It was the Russia had the clear advantage and was pressing it. It just wasn't. It didn't fit the narrative that the West wanted to see. You know, what we're used to seeing in our war movies, how things are ended. But no, this is not a stalemate, and it's not going to linger on for years and years and years. You know, Russia's going to put they're going to put an end to this.
I think the only way that they can put it on the battlefield, nothing else so far. Donald Trump has proven that Russia needs just its own military, nothing else, more than that.
Well, can you imagine, let's again put it into context. In this last week, on one day they launched, you know, 500 drones and missiles. Next day, 500 drones and missiles. Next day, 700 drones. How many missiles combined did Israel and Iran fire at each other over 12 days? Not that many, you know? So, I mean, it's just the scale of the violence is so much larger, what's going on in Ukraine, than anything that took place between Iran and Israel. So it's just, people need to put it in a proper perspective. Look at what's actually happening. And, you know, I think Russia's foot is on the accelerator now, and they're going to break Ukraine militarily.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
Glad to brighten your Friday. And thanks for getting the shirt straight this time. Okay.
See you soon, Larry. See you on Monday.
I will talk to you on Monday. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.